Good afternoon, folks. Go ahead, and I know I don't want to interrupt the conversation. I know some of these, the best conversations happen during the meal. Last week, we were actually in Chicago for our big global Metro Summit. The Brookings Institution sponsored it with the Alfred Herrhausen Society of Germany and the London School of Economics, a big international thing. And we learned a lot that week. We also learned that in some countries, it's very rude and impolite to have a speaker while food is being served and while folks are eating. Fortunately, our speaker today, Barry LePatner, is not so thin-skinned, so folks should continue to eat. There's dessert back there. There's drinks, coffee, and you know, I think they're bringing some more salad, too, so please feel free to continue eating. But as many of us around in this room know, you know, there's nothing like a tragedy to really take infrastructure and to push it to the front burner of the American policy discourse. We can all kind of roll off the litany of these tragic events and these problems, the levees in New Orleans, the steam pipe in New York, the sewage system in Baltimore. No, Boston is where it was. The gas line explosion, where was it recently, in suburban San Francisco, and, of course, the I-35 bridge in Minneapolis. And while I genuinely believe that these horrible failures do serve to compel action, we all know that sometimes and oftentimes it really doesn't. We have these big conversations. There's a lot of fury and a lot of hand-wringing for a bit, and then the conversation kind of goes away. I think people hear about these things, and they start to happen so frequently that they're almost becoming numb to just the insurmountableness of the infrastructure problems I think that we have here in this country and the things that we're facing today. There are issues like high-speed rail, these new investments, these new gleaming, brand-new investments that tend to dominate the conversation. But while we're having those conversations, which are good, we tend then to forget about the existing infrastructure in the existing places that's serving the existing economy and serving existing people. That's why Barry LePatner's book and why his work is so important today. If we think about U.S. infrastructure only when there are these failures or only when there are these problems, and we treat it with a bridge here or a rail line there or something else here, I think it will be very tough for us to build the kind of broad support that we need to deal with these huge challenges that we know that we're all facing today. And this is especially true when we're confronted with just the size of the problem and these things like the $2.3 trillion bill that we have for fixing infrastructure, which, Brian, we think is the right number, but these things are so huge, these numbers are so large, and I think this is part of the reason why there is maybe this numbness. It just seems like these problems are too big to tackle. Yet while I think most of these talks then focus on the money and where are we going to find the money to deal with this problem for these recent repairs or these needed repairs and investments, Barry's work really does compel us to think differently about how we maintain our infrastructure and then how we're going to build smartly for the future. So while money obviously dominates the conversation and folks here in this room are probably genuinely consumed with that conversation, we've got to figure out what's wrong with why. How do we get to the point where we are today and how are we going to fix it? It's not just a money conversation. So you're all probably familiar with Barry's work. He's been called a guru of the construction industry reform. He's been called a Cassandra of infrastructure. He's the author of several books on the construction industry, on articles on real estate, many articles on infrastructure, and even has a very cool book called Quotes on the Business of Life. Is that what it's called? Very cool book. You should pick that up. In his spare time, he's the founder of the New York law firm LePatner & Associates. His latest book, which he'll talk about today, is Too Big to Fail, Too Big to Fall, America's Failing Infrastructure and the Way Forward. Please join me in welcoming Barry LePatner.
Thank you, Robert. It's really a great pleasure to be here at the Brookings Institution and to have the opportunity to speak in front of so many distinguished people, so many who have given so much of their lives to furthering the cause of transportation and infrastructure and who are truly sophisticated and knowledgeable about a subject that is so important to our nation. And it is a subject, however important, which seems always to get kind of submerged between other issues. And reports on two wars, reports on healthcare, reports on the financial debt, all of these somehow make it seem like the subject of infrastructure, you know, is kind of in the second, third tier in our society. And I wrote this book, Too Big to Fall, to hopefully start a debate in the nation to recognize that there is nothing more fundamental to what allows our nation to be strong and powerful and a world leader than having a spine, a network of infrastructure that is serving the purpose for which it was originally intended. So that's what I want to focus on today, and I hope I spur some real debate, or at least allow you to see some of this stuff in a little bit different perspective through this speech. A young lady you don't know, her name is Mercedes Gordon, works at a Best Buy in the Human Resources Department in Minneapolis. On Tuesday, August 1, 2007, it started out as a great day for her. She got a promotion. She got a raise. And she had only recently just gotten engaged. That was great. But later that day, as she went home from work, she crossed the western span of the I-35W, which crossed the Mississippi River. And as she got to the other side of the bridge, in her words, she said, "I started to see the bridge begin to look like a wave in the ocean. It rippled. Then the entire bridge collapsed. Her car plunged six stories, and the fall crushed her leg, broke her back. But she survived. They found her Ford Escort under two other cars. 84 vehicles and more than 200 people fell from as high as 116 feet. One in 20 of them died." Well, sad and tragic stories happen every day. But as I explain in my book, Too Big to Fall, this particular story is not that rare in our nation. I tell it as an example of what has already happened and what will continue to happen more and more often if our leaders in this country don't take action. Our roads and bridges truly are ticking time bombs. They are tragedies waiting to happen. State transportation departments and the Federal Highway Administration do not publicly discuss the true nature of these fragile structures over which millions of tons of goods travel daily and millions of our citizens as well. Yes, they acknowledge regularly that one in four of our 600,000 bridges are either structurally deficient or functionally obsolete, terms which no layman has a clue what means. And they still assure the public that those bridges are safe as long as state and local transportation departments are regularly monitoring these bridges and sometimes limiting the traffic that crosses them. So they're all safe to travel on. But based on the research I undertook for this book and supported by some of the nation's most experienced engineers, I've identified 8,000 bridges designed during the 1960s and 1970s called fracture critical bridges. And this is the term you have to import into your lexicon. Forget structurally deficient. Forget functionally obsolete. Pay attention to what the engineers know for a fact, that a fracture critical bridge is a bridge designed where if one critical member of the bridge fails, one piece, the entire bridge goes down like a house of cards. A fracture critical bridge is truly that. It has no redundancy, no path of supporting the load once that one member fails. So what does this all mean? You need to understand that these are not isolated bridges throughout our nation, and they're not sprinkled randomly across state to state. In total today, we have 18,000 fracture-critical bridges. Bridges that were designed back in the 60s and 70s, as I mentioned, because they were cost-effective, quick to put up, and therefore they work to help complete our national highway system. But there are a total of 7,980 bridges, and this is statistics that my research gleaned from the genetic code of the Federal Highway Administration for every one of the 600,000 bridges in our nation. 7,980, which are not only fracture critical, but also by virtue of the conditions ratings of the states, they are structurally deficient, meaning that on a scale of 1 to 10, they are rated 4 or poor because of lack of maintenance. And that means they are highly vulnerable to collapse, just like the I-35W that went down summarily on that day in August 1, 2007. And what the public has also not been told is that over the last two decades, since 1989, nearly 600 bridges in this nation have failed. And without immediate repair, those nearly 8,000 fracture-critical and structurally deficient bridges are going to fail as well. Imagine that your grandmother gave you her wonderful old wicker rocking chair, and it's something that she enjoyed and she wanted you to enjoy. And you left it out in your backyard one summer day and kept it there for a season or two without paying any attention to it. Do that for 20 or more years to a bridge, and you'll find that that bridge is going to be in very much the similar condition as that wicker rocking chair. You'd be scared to sit in it once it was in that weakened state. But to get here today, some of you probably went over bridges that are in pretty much the same condition. Just yesterday, the local papers reported that in Maryland, in Montgomery and Prince George's County, there are 14 structurally deficient bridges, including the I-495 at University Boulevard, which is a fracture-critical bridge. And the worst one in the area, was noted, is the one at the South Capitol Street Bridge near the new stadium. It's barely hanging on. And by all reports, as a fracture-critical bridge, I'd stay off that bridge if I were you. We have 160 on average bridges like that throughout each of the states of this nation. We send millions of our children over school buses across these bridges every day. Trains, 18-wheelers, ambulances, fire trucks, and your family on the way to the grocery store or to church. It's truly the equivalent of highway Russian roulette. Maybe you made it today, but is there any guarantee that you'll make it tomorrow? That's what the engineers say. It's not what I say. And I'm not just talking here only about roads and bridges. We have the same problem when you study tunnels, levees, dams, water and sewer pipes, the power grid. The whole of American infrastructure has fallen into a state of serious disrepair. The risk alone to life of our American citizens is enough to merit action. But imagine the effect on our economy if even one or two of our primary arteries were shut down because of future failures. Those roads and bridges make commerce possible. Close off a few key points of economic circulation today, and it's like a heart attack to an economy that's already severely weakened. Yet following the collapse of the I-35W, the NTSB, after a 14-month investigation, put out a report that when you study it and look at the facts behind how that bridge was managed, all of which were left out of that report, could be considered nothing less than a whitewash. I've left a paper for you that analyzes each of the findings of that report, and I urge you to examine it to see how truly we have been failed by an agency that could have done a great deal of good by urging our country to take the steps that I urge in my new book. How do things get so bad? Well, part of the reason is this subject is not readily viewed as a crisis by the way our leaders look at it. It's exciting for politicians to plan and promise a new bridge. They love to stand next to oversized renderings of the new bridge against a brilliant blue sky. But to maintain one, nobody gets too excited about that. And no politician wants to spend limited capital budget expenditures on something you can't see, something you can't show your constituents, or have a ribbon-cutting ceremony with happy campaign contributors at your side. From the outside, a new bridge looks pretty much like an old one. And when we say a bridge works, what that really means is we're saying, the last time I went over it, it looked like it was a good bridge. It didn't fall. Well, that's not the criteria. And in fact, the unspoken thoughts of bridge managers, politicians, and citizens is that, in fact, they're too big to fall. But a bridge is not just a road over water any more than a computer is a box with wires sticking out of it. All bridges move. A bridge is literally thousands of moving parts. And if each part is to work properly, it must have regular attention. It's a finely calibrated machine, much like a car or an airplane. And eventually, without needed maintenance, it wears out. This is a case where gravity always wins. Why is that? Wind and weather cause corrosion and rust. The rumble of traffic loosens joints and weakens material strength. Fracture cracks in decks and piers begin to appear. Bridges are designed to expand and contract and even twist to accommodate wind, temperature changes, and traffic conditions. Bearings on a bridge allow it to account for these adjustments. But without careful attention, the bearings that make movement possible eventually freeze. To put a nationwide perspective on this, you can go to the most recent report from the American Society of Civil Engineers, which gave America's infrastructure a grade of D. As bad as bridges are by themselves, they earned a C. The rest of our infrastructure is even worse. Dams received a D. Levees, D minus. Aviation, a D. Railroads, C minus. And roads themselves got a D minus. Let me talk for a few moments about the policies that are needed to change the way we approach our nation's decaying infrastructure. Like many problems of political will, this one begins with money. According to the Surface Transportation Infrastructure Financing Commission, the annual shortfall for infrastructure maintenance in the U.S. through the year 2035 ranges from $134 to $194 billion. And that's just for maintenance. If you want to talk about any improvement to the system, the shortfall rises to over $250 billion a year. We all know that straightforward government financing is not going to work, not in this political environment, and not for something that can't be presented visually as a life-threatening crisis, even though it is. So we're going to have to go and give serious consideration to raising the gas tax. It may not happen now or tomorrow or the next day, but as sure as everything is certain, anyone who's ever studied this subject knows that that gas tax has to go up. Those who don't travel regularly on our roads subsidize those that do, and we subsidize them heavily. It was last raised in 1993 to 18.4 cents a gallon, and it's stayed the same at that rate ever since. The U.S. is also going to have to turn increasingly to public-private partnerships, beginning with the creation of a valid P3 model that will pass muster with the American public. The successful model is going to have to thread its way through a proverbial needle. We need a system that merges public and private objectives while accommodating or simply overcoming powerful interests in business and labor, and from politicians themselves, who see little overt benefit from administrating preventive medicine to ailing bridges and roads. We're going to need to construct a better model for implementing a P3 investment, because in recent years, the P3 model that we use has not fared all that well. While some have been successful, others, such as rejection of the proposed long-term lease of the Pennsylvania Turnpike, have been just undergoing withering attacks, as even in spite of the fact that it offered a $12.7 billion upfront payment. Going forward, we have to develop due diligence and financial models that will encourage P3 investments while serving to protect motorists, commercial users, public employees, taxpayers, and other stakeholders. For P3s to work, we will need to include provisions that place limitations on toll increases over a long-term period of time. We're going to need agreements that specify acceptable levels of service and maintenance and implement the use of analytical tools called value for money, which are used widely in the UK and Australia to examine total project costs and benefits to really see if a P3 is going to be in the best interests of the public. The proposal for the National Infrastructure Bank right now is pretty much a tabula rasa, which is pretty good because it may give us an opportunity to set it up in the most effective way. It will need to secure acceptable rates of return like a regular bank, while at the same time promoting defined policy goals, making it a very specialized kind of bank. The European Investment Bank has done this successfully, and with some modifications, perhaps we can follow the rule here as well. Robert Puentes, our host for this afternoon, wrote in the foreword to my book, and I quote, "We cannot keep pouring money into a fundamentally broken system. It's not about finding the cash and building new projects. It's really about changing the way we do business. We need more transparency in the system, and we need more accountability. This extends to reining in the highly inefficient construction industry, which will be needed to help us rebuild. Following the recent elections, state governors have begun to renounce federal funding in the billions of dollars because of the concern that their states would be responsible for huge construction cost overruns that accompany all such mega projects. That's the major reason why Governor Chris Christie of New Jersey canceled a long-planned $8.7 billion rail tunnel under the Hudson River. Newly elected governors in Wisconsin and Ohio canceled rail projects for the same reason. They made what I believe to be policy errors that over the long term will prove truly not to have been beneficial to their states. We must fight against the knee-jerk instinct to withdraw funding from infrastructure projects regardless of the imperatives urged by some in government. Short-term thinking in this arena is bound to have serious long-term repercussions when all the factors are calculated. Governor Christie's concern was based on the thought that construction cost overruns in excess of $5 billion on this nearly $9 billion project would be devastating to his state. But his rejection, in turn, has triggered demands for the return of $271 million by the state of New Jersey to the federal government to reimburse project planning costs for the past 10 years. The state is going to also lose $3 billion in federal transit grants for a much-needed transportation project. And 6,000 construction workers committed to the project are now going to join the ranks of 1.7 million unemployed construction workers. For Ohio and Wisconsin, these states now stand to lose $1.2 billion in federal grants and cost over 10,000 construction jobs and related project development jobs. What Governor Christie fails to realize is that cost overruns can be prevented through sophisticated negotiations. Agreement on a true fixed cost for a project can be secured before construction begins. Identifying the risks that are generally foreseeable on every transportation and infrastructure project are capable of being identified, priced, and negotiated as part of a true fixed price if they occur. And then, and only then, can we go to the federal government and ask the federal government to help backstop those contingencies if they occur. But in any event, there will not be uncertain, unknowing costs for government and taxpayers for each of these mega projects. They will be capped, identified, and a true fixed price to protect the taxpayers of our states. Hope you will take the white paper that I have at the back of the room, which can show you exactly how these projects can be negotiated and the construction industry reined in to handle the uncertainty of the cost overruns that are making so many projects around this country untenable. Economists understand that in every past recession, construction has always led the nation towards a job-related recovery. What is desperately needed today are jobs that will not merely involve shovel-ready short-term construction projects. What is needed is to assign the nearly 2 million unemployed contractors over the next 2 years to projects that are in most serious need of remediation. And the ones I would propose are to take those 7,980 structurally deficient and fracture-critical bridges, identify the ones that carried over 20,000 vehicles a day. Let's call it one-third of those 8,000. Let's call it 3,000 bridges. And assign a value to fix the lack of redundancy at a cost which probably will not exceed $9 billion across the nation. We will have remediated the current jeopardy to our citizens' safety and to the commerce that flows over those bridges for a small fraction of the transportation budget. We will have put 2 million construction workers to work across our nation for 2 years. And we will have shown that infrastructure is a priority in this country that needs attention today. Since its founding, the U.S. has always been a nation that builds great things. The Erie Canal in 1819, the Transcontinental Railroad in the 1870s, the Interstate Highway after World War II. Americans know how to build boldly, and we know how to build well. But we don't do a good job of maintaining what we build. That mindset reduces our safety, security, and economic strength to a competition between hope and gravity. And that's one contest where gravity always wins. In 1983, I testified before U.S. Congress in what was its last significant investigation of major structural failures. In the 27 years since then, the federal government has not taken a single substantive step to address the outdated way in which the construction industry operates. Nor has our nation addressed the deterioration of our infrastructure during that time. Now the clock is running out, and we don't have another 27 years to delay action. We can no longer afford to ignore the depth of the transportation funding crisis that has crippled our nation's roads and bridges. We can no longer ignore the serious consequences that will unfold if we fail to act now. And we can no longer treat maintenance of our infrastructure as a second or third tier priority when it comes to funding. The risks we face are not limited to the dangers the traveling public face. They include jeopardizing our entire commercial sector as well as our national security network. We continue to fall further behind from our worldwide competitors. Infrastructure investment in China is running at 9% of GDP. In Western Europe, the figure is 5% of GDP. In our nation, the figure is 2% of our GDP. For decades, leaders at all levels of government have failed to recognize these risks. But the time has come for each of them to acknowledge that their constituencies and our nation can no longer afford to be left in danger. Tom Friedman recently wrote in an op-ed column for the New York Times something that speaks to our nation's prospects for the future. He said, and I quote, "The long-term concern is that what we need most now is nation-building in America. People understand it by just looking around at our crumbling infrastructure. But we have to get this nation-building right because we're driving without a spare tire or a bumper. And we have to get this moment right. We don't get a do-over. If we fail to come together and invest, spend, and cut really wisely, we're heading for a fall," he said. "And if America becomes weak, your kids just won't grow up in a different country. They will grow up in a different world." A few weeks ago, I had the chance to speak with Chris Messerly, the attorney in Minneapolis who handled many of the victims of the I-35W bridge disaster, including Mercedes Gordon, who I mentioned at the outset of my speech. I asked him, "Chris, tell me, what was the most personally difficult part of representing those who had so unexpectedly lost family members or incurred life-threatening injuries after falling into the Mississippi River?" He said, "Unquestionably, Barry, it was handing out settlement checks ranging from $50,000 to $7 million to families where no amount of money could have dealt with the trauma they had lived through. America's future as a world leader will only be secured if we pursue a course of action that promotes vision over apathy. For our leaders to fall back upon timidity and fearfulness when bold projects and new ideas are needed is to see our nation willfully decide to become a third-class citizen of the world. In the final analysis, faced with the challenges of a nation confronted by financial and political uncertainty, I'm comforted by the words of Ralph Waldo Emerson, who compared his era to one that we can identify with today. He wrote, "This time, like all times, is a very good one, if we but know what to do with it." Our citizens are looking for an honest solution to the problems I've outlined this afternoon. They're no longer content to listen to a battle of sound bites that comes forth from Washington each day. They no longer wish to see a Congress pulled in every direction that money can buy. And our transportation system is too important to be sacrificed on that altar. Merely throwing fresh money at the problem is no solution for what we have to deal with. In the final analysis, we need to reprioritize how we allocate funding. And we need to put money towards the most critically needed projects. We need to deploy new technology to save untold billions in maintenance costs because we have that advanced technology available today. We don't need studies and grants from NIST. We don't need universities studying these problems. We need to monitor up many of these bridges because that will save billions in maintenance costs. And we need to reform the system of how we disperse these funds around the nation. I remain hopeful that our leaders can engage in the full debate needed to come to the right conclusion. But I do know that when it comes to the perilous state of our infrastructure, failure to take action is no longer an option. Thank you very much.
So the reason that we invited the folks in the room, the reason we wanted Barry to come here today, I mean, the folks here, so as Sarah, as we talked about, we represent both the highway departments, the transit agencies, construction industry, civil engineers, range of advocates. We wanted then, kind of, we have plenty of time left to engage then in kind of a dialogue about the issues that he presented, and then what do we do about it? I think that as we talked about just before, you know, we're kind of consumed with the paralysis, I think, that folks think is happening in Washington. But as we talked about earlier, it may not be paralysis. It may just be polarization. But things are going to happen. here in Washington. We're going to be doing a bunch of different things. Infrastructure, we maintain, is one of those things that the federal government has to act on. Over the next couple of years, while we're kind of doing all this hand-wringing, trying to figure out, you know, where the federal government is going to engage to build the next economy, to move us forward, this is one of the areas we think is critically important to do something. So, again, for the next few minutes, we want to just keep it kind of informal, and we'll open it up to questions, comments, and people.
Sure. I wanted to start with a factual question and perhaps a more compelling one later. But on your definition, fracture critical bridge, I'm not clear in my mind if that's a design problem or if that's a maintenance problem. It sounds like if it's built that way so as one piece can cause the whole thing to come down, that's a design problem rather than a maintenance problem. But perhaps I'm wrong on that.
No, you're correct. It's a design problem.
Yeah.
This was a mechanism for building bridges fast and cheaper through the 60s and the 70s. Remember, back in those days, the interstate highway system was going full speed right across this country, north and south. And they needed to find mechanisms to get bridges up quickly and cheaply to fit into the budgets of what was then the Highway Trust Fund being funded through this newfangled gasoline tax. So they did many, many thousands of them, of which today identified on the Federal Highway Administration genetic code for each bridge in the system. There are 18,000 of them around the country, of which, as I mentioned, nearly 8,000 of them are also structurally deficient.
Is that practice continuing, or is it is that a historic practice?
It stopped. In the late 70s, no longer did that type of design get built. Redundancy was added and treated as a necessary concomitant of all future bridges today.
Are most of those bridges then, are those pre-1970?
Yeah, pre-1980. You know, I think it ended in 1978, was the exact year. And having been identified as fracture critical, there have been papers this thick that I have read on what happens and what's the level of inspection and maintenance that are needed on these fracture critical bridges. They're inspected every year. So to allow them to deteriorate, for any Department of Transportation to know what they are and allow them to deteriorate is inexcusable. And engineers understand this concept. They will fall. Someone asked me, how would we prove this? And I said, it's very simple. Take a bridge engineer, the individual in charge of bridges in a given state, sit him down and make sure the governor of that state is there, the congressman, and the head of the transportation department for that state. Ask that engineer a series of questions. You understand what structurally deficient is? Oh, yes, on the rating 1 to 10, this is a 4. That means it's poor. And what does a bridge on your state have to do to get to be that way? Well, we have corrosion loss, which we call section loss. We have fracture grids. We have problems on the bearings. We have all sorts of things that are lack of maintenance. And you understand the term fracture critical, and they'll tell you exactly what that is because every engineer is highly knowledgeable about that. And you say, so when we have a structurally deficient bridge that is also fracture critical, that's sort of like the I-35W. Oh, that's exactly like the I-35W. So let me understand. Can you sit here with your congressman, with your governor, and with the head of your transportation department and tell them that no problem, these bridges cannot fall down today, tomorrow, next year, or 2 years? Or would you have to say to them, it could fall tomorrow? And every engineer in the country must admit, yeah, they could go down tomorrow, because if one piece fails because some hugely overloaded 18-wheeler bounced, or because, like on the I-35W, they negligently allowed 575,000 pounds of construction material to be put on that bridge in an asymmetrically loaded way that caused a problem with one piece. And if you go back and you look on Google, on YouTube or anything else, to see the pictures of the bridge that collapsed, and they have them as they went down, as the I-35W went down, it went down like this. And that's one of the – it didn't collapse and spin everybody into the Mississippi River, because if that had happened, there would have been greater number of people killed on that rush hour. What happened was the bridge went down this way, and students on a school bus had a hell of a 100, you know, foot drop, but they went straight down and landed this way and didn't get tipped over into the river. That's what happens when a fracture critical bridge goes down. And I will have in months ahead an actual video showing what happens on a fracture critical bridge as the pieces first start to go and what it's like to be on that bridge. It is frightening. Yes. Yes.
Towards the highest capacity parts of the system. Others are more interested in spreading it out over a broader network. And you get two very different outcomes here. So there's a prevention question, I guess, to ask. Mm-hmm. And the third one, I think, that's related to it. Some of us in this room out of these bridges, adding pedestrian or bike or rail capacity. That rebuilding can hurry to the exact building with something functionally better. So one of the things that seems to me your analysis, which is excellent, points to is making the case for the right thing. Because if doing it in a hurry is what got us into trouble,
right.
Doing it over in a hurry is likely to create yet other sorts of problems. So it seems like there's a role here to take a little time to get the spec on the repair right. And I'm wondering what you thought about, both from the point of view of prevention.
I think it's an excellent question. Let me get to your first one, because it's really the most critical. If you have a family member around this country who's going over a fracture critical bridge, you want it fixed tomorrow. Limiting the traffic on that is not the solution, okay? Because it's that dangerous, okay? One piece goes down, and you can't tell what's going to be the trigger. No engineer can tell you that limiting the traffic means that if there's a corrosion on a structural member that has eaten into half of its width and a car or a truck bangs on it or hits it at a certain angle, if it goes, the whole facility goes down. So I think in triaging, I would attend to the ones that are in most danger today. And that is a fracture-critical bridge that has also been rated structurally deficient. And the departments know about that. How do I know? Last year, I sent a questionnaire around to 50 state transportation commissioners. And I asked them very generic questions, because hidden in the generic questions were, how many fracture-critical bridges do you have in your state, and how many of them are structurally deficient? 36 out of the 50 commissioners responded to that survey. I lost a bet in my office because everybody said, you'll get back two. 36 responded and verified what we had seen by decoding the genetic code from the Federal Highway Administration and so on. So they know about the seriousness of this. They cannot disclose it and so on. Now, in terms of what other alternatives can we have, let's understand that today there are perverse incentives for a state to let a bridge deteriorate. What do I mean? If you have a bridge that's new, were you to maintain it at the cost of $1 million a year, that comes out of your state general budget. If you let it deteriorate, and 20 years later you now rate it structurally deficient or poor, you qualify for federal funding. So you're better off to get monies from the federal government by letting your bridges deteriorate. And then what have they done? In the last transportation bill in 2005, there was a little-known provision that said We're sending all this money to the states, but in applying this money to the states, we are not allowing the federal government to intrude upon the sovereign rights of the states to use this for whatever purpose they choose, which means each state governor, congressman, transportation commissioners knew they did not have to dedicate that money where it was directed for remediation. And when we traced many of the states and where the money went, we found out that, in fact, Minnesota, like other states, took most of that money and applied it for new projects as opposed to remediation. So we have to rethink, as you say, what each individual project should do, and we should do it on a cost-benefit basis. My book recommends that we start to asset manage each of these bridges and look at whether it's needed or not. Look at it whether it's next to a toll road, which has a brand new bridge. Should we be treating that structurally deficient, fracture-critical bridge, or should we just close it and let everybody decide whether they want to move over to a toll road or change this? We need a transportation czar to help make decisions. In other words, we got to start looking at this on a regional basis. What's the sense of adding $5 billion to expand the port of Long Beach in Southern California when to bring in 4 billion new tons of cargo when all they would do is line up waiting to get on the 5 or the 405 and couldn't go anywhere for 3 days because of the congestion in the Southern California highways? We got to think these things through. It's not being done because it's being treated on a case-by-case, project-by-project, state-by-state basis. We have to start seeing our transportation system as not just a system, but it's, as I think Robert Puentes once pointed out, a network of networks, and realizing the interworkings of all of these different kinds of systems. And that's before we get to the subject of congestion on our roads, which costs our nation almost $89 billion a year, and so on. Yes, Robert Mortimer. And the formula could be worked out once you have a true fixed price. For instance, if you're building a tunnel, the concern is, I don't know how the contractors are going to deem some risks that could come up that they're going to put 30 and 40% more onto the project cost. Okay, well, we sit down and we say to those contractors, let's talk about the foreseeable risks that you believe could lead to contingencies. So contractor says, I think aliens once arrived right where the tunnel is and they built a concrete block 500 feet by 500 feet. And if it's down there, we want to be paid for that. I said, okay, that might happen. Let's quantify that. You're going to need how much labor to take that out, how long, and how much money? Well, that's $2 billion. Okay, if it happens, we agree to cap it at $2 billion. If it doesn't happen, it's just a line item that never eventuated. But if you list the 5 or 10 or 20 potential contingencies that could happen and you price them in advance, you have no uncertainties because from that point on, the contractor to sign the contract has to waive its right to make claims for any extras. They've given you a true fixed price for this tunnel. We've identified what they're concerned about as contingencies. We've priced them. We've added them as contingencies. That doesn't mean they're going to be spent. And we've backstopped them, federal, state, P3, whoever's going to be investing in that. And we all know it might or might not happen. Every stakeholder will share in it. But we will now not worry about unlimited cost overruns, which plague 100% of every big project in America today. We've got to stop an inefficient construction industry from running amok over our economy. We don't have the money anymore, and this is the only way to do it. Yes, go ahead. Well, I think they ask the wrong questions. And I think they show a lack of understanding of how the construction industry operates. Construction industry operate in not only the United States, but in every civilized country in the world, is the most inefficient industry that exists. It is the lowest user of technology. And in fact, I once wrote a major article for the Boston Globe called "The Industry That Time Forgot." We build today the same way we built hundreds and thousands of years ago. And believe it or not, you have to read my other book, Broken Buildings, Busted Budgets, the entire construction industry is a mom-and-pop industry. There are no major companies like Dell, General Motors, Ford, NBC, Universal Studios. There are no companies like that. You can name a big, big, big company. It has a few thousand workers. It doesn't have 30,000, 40,000 workers. 92% of all contractors in our nation, and up until 2 years ago, there were over 9 million contractors working in the industry, 92% work for a company that has 19 or fewer people in it. 84% of all contractors work for a company that has 10 or fewer. It is truly mom and pop. And when you see a big project going up, it's not General Motors building it. It's a construction manager who puts five people on that job to make sure they all show up. And then 20, 30, or 40 companies pull up in panel trucks every day or don't. And work or don't work. And if they don't work, whenever they get to it, they do. But the owner pays for it because that's if you don't pay for it, they don't work and they go off the job. And that's the end of the project. So they are hugely inefficient and it's really small. We rein them in by making them responsible for assuming risks. In today's marketplace, where 2 million workers are out of work because there are that much fewer jobs, you can readily, and we do it every day for our clients, negotiate with the construction industry by pricing the exact cost of a project. You can price it if you know how to price it. And put independent cost estimators on. Read that white paper and you'll see how it can be done. And then get the construction industry to accept the risk of finishing on time and on budget if they want the project. The responsible companies will sign that and waive their right to make construction cost overrun claims. Then we rein them in. We have construction cost certainty. And we're no longer held hostage to an inefficient construction industry. We can't allow unwarranted, unlimited construction costs claims to take over and hold us hostage. We just cannot do that, especially as we want to rebuild America. We're going to have another 100 million people in our population by 2050. That's what the census says. That's what a 2003 Brookings Institution report by Arthur C. Nelson says. And we're going to rebuild America, and we're going to be building into new cities and new towns and new infrastructure. But we can't spend the money on that with an open-ended pocketbook. We don't have that money. We're not going to have it for a long time to come. So true fixed price certainty should be built into every project we do of any scale in this country. Then we have certainty. Yeah. Well, I'm in the process now of geomapping all of these 8,000 so that we can have a public website so everybody can see within 100 miles of wherever you click on your Google map, you will see all the little red dots showing you the bridge, the name of it, you know, how many cars go over it, and whether your mother-in-law should go over it, and if you don't like her, you don't tell her and let her go over it, you know. And nobody's dying from an underfunded pension fund, yeah.
Right. And so it seems to me that the other side of this issue is how you actually get accountability out of the system. I appreciate what you had to say about the ability of engineers to know these things. Engineers aren't in charge of decisions that get made here.
Yes.
And as you point out, we have a federal, state, local, et cetera, system. So it doesn't seem like we've heard a model yet to how to actually
I'm going to make an analogy. It may not be a perfect one. There is an argument that the $100 billion we spend in Afghanistan each year goes on and on and on because there aren't too many members of Congress or the administration whose children are in that war. There are a few, but not that many. I guarantee you, if there's a public map showing that members of Congress and their constituents and their families are going over a bridge every day that puts their children and their families in jeopardy, I'll bet you that somebody figures out there's one pork barrel legislative item, earmark item, that would be worth fixing. So we've got to personalize this. We've got to bring this down to a human level and explain to people it's America, it's baseball, it's apple pie, and it's the safety of our citizens at risk. Yes, ma'am. I tell you, if we start this dialogue and explain fracture critical, not structurally deficient, I hope everybody walks out of here not caught up with this word structurally deficient. It's fracture critical. If we start this dialogue, then we can easily transfigure it. over into dams and levees, the power grid, and every other, because people will take this and use it in their own way to say, let's triage the dams that are in danger in Los Angeles and those places. Thank you. Well, when you read my book, what you come away with, and this is what scared me when I talked to engineer after engineer, a bridge, and let me say this to all of you, a bridge that is structurally deficient, rated poor, is a bridge that has already failed. Okay, it's failed because the transportation department is duty-bound to limit the amount of traffic, which means the original design intent of that bridge is no longer capable of being followed. The bridge is already damaged. I have a section of the book where I talk about the horrible tragedy of the Challenger flight that blew up in space and the investigation that followed, and talk about the Minority Report by Richard Feynman, the brilliant scientist who was truly in the minority, but very right. And he found out that on prior shuttle flights, the O-ring, rubber ring that keeps oxygen out from getting into a critical part of them, which blew up, he found out that on prior flights, the O-ring deteriorated because of cold weather by a factor of a third. Management said, of NASA, said, see, it worked. There's a 1 in 100,000 chance that we will have a future failure from that item. That's what they rated it as. And they said, go on to the next flight. The engineers on the line said, it's a 1 in 100 factor. Feynman says, what the engineers knew, but that management refused to acknowledge, was the O-ring had already failed. And he goes on, and I quote him in the book, and he goes on and says, just like a bridge that has already been told you have to limit the amount of traffic, that bridge has also failed as well. And the analogy is scary, because if the NTSB had read what Feynman wrote in his dissenting report to the Challenger Commission, which was run by Bill Rogers, the former Secretary of State, if they had read that, they wouldn't have put out a defective, misleading report to the nation on the cause of the I-35W. That was a true whitewash, and I hope you read the analysis of what I've done to take apart that report, which served as no lesson to this country to avoid future failures. Just like when an aircraft goes down because of a crack in an engine, they stop all future flights of similar aircraft until they're certified as being safe. We haven't done that in this country with respect to roads, bridges, levees, dams, and the power grid, and we need to change that. Yes, ma'am. If I were very rich, I would get in my corporate jet with you this afternoon. We would fly to Minneapolis, and we would walk around to all the people in the community right around the I-35W, which collapsed, and say, put aside the fact that people died here or injured, what was the damage to your community that occurred? And you would hear it was about $1 billion worth of damage to the community. Businesses went out of business because there was no traffic coming right off the bridge. People had to go 5, 10, 20 miles out of their way every day for 14, 16 months until they rebuilt that bridge. So if you take the personal side out of it, yeah, that's, you know, it's, I'm not going to fall on a bridge. Too big to fall. Not when I go over it. Put that aside. The commercial aspect of it. You have to understand that every day across our nation's bridges, just take the 3,000 I'm talking about that are structurally deficient and fracture critical, you're having tens of billions of dollars of commerce going over them in Costco trucks, Walmart trucks, railroad trains are going over them. I asked a railroad president, because I was at an infrastructure conference, I asked a railroad president, when you do your risk management every year, do you factor in that your railroads are going over fracture-critical bridges that are structurally deficient, and what would happen if they one of them went down, and how you would manage it? The guy looked at me and says, are you crazy? We don't do anything of the sort. And therein lies the lack of understanding of the impact of our infrastructure on the daily commerce of this country. We move $1 zillion worth of commerce every day on the basis that these bridges are going to be there and the roads leading up to them are functioning. So if you want to say the Russian roulette idea for the average person, you know, if it, like Feynman said in his book, is the fact that you play Russian roulette, boom, you hit an empty chamber, does not give you any sense of confidence that the next time you pull the trigger, it's going to be safe. That's the concept we have to understand about these things. Yes, ma'am.
You've talked a lot about the safety aspects of the infrastructure failures, but if you could talk a little bit also about the efficiency that we're facing now. You talked some about the problems of efficiency if they do fall. But, you know, there are bridges now that, or how many bridges now have limited traffic because they wouldn't be able to handle. I guess when we're looking at infrastructure first to avoid further capacity building, we need to look at the efficiency.
Let's put this into a larger context. In our urban areas, when we limit the amount of traffic that can go over a bridge, we are adding to congestion. And let me give you some numbers about congestion. Some of you may know these numbers. Some of you may be startled by them. In our nation today, according to the 2009 Texas Transportation Institute report, we had over $4.2 million hit to our national economy by virtue of congestion alone. It was the equivalent of everyone who's on the road today having one full week a year doing nothing, just sitting in traffic. One full week a year. $4.2 billion in wasted gasoline. And I don't have no idea how many tankerfuls that is. Somebody once rated them. When we have to close a bridge, shut it down, limit the traffic, and we add to that, we're doing another disservice because the network of networks, the transportation system that feeds all of this, is really, really clogging itself to death. And you can't talk about high-speed rail or local transit systems where they want to put in short-term rail systems within cities. You can't talk about that without talking about taking away from congestion that is holding our cities and our nation back from future growth. All of this has to be factored in. Unfortunately, we find out that a lot of these factors are not being considered jointly when a particular project is being considered. And we need to start seeing the national ambit of what all this means as if we went up into the sky and are looking down, not on that particular road or bridge, but on what it means to the region, to a state, to the other highways, roads, bridges, dams that are around there. Those are the factors. We've got to have that discussion to see the asset value of a project in a real context today. Yes, sir.
Paul Feenster from ITS America.
Remember who you are. Sorry.
Yeah. Paul Feenster from ITS America. You have a chapter in your book called The Technological Imperative where you talk about advanced condition assessment technologies.
Yes.
To monitor bridges and other infrastructure, what role do you see of that playing in helping to prioritize, if you will, the management of the bridges and other infrastructure assets? And why do you think we don't see more use of these types of technologies?
The dollars that we could spend on that type of advanced technology to monitor our roads and our bridges and our dams is the best dollars that we could spend today. Peter Van Der Zee, who's in this room today, who provided some fascinating insights into that, said he believes that if we monitored the structurally deficient bridges in this nation today, that a good percentage of those bridges would be taken off the list, because he believes that that perverse incentive I talked about, where, hey, let's just give it a 4 and we start getting federal monies coming into our government, is widespread because it's easy for inspectors to take that road. Whether or not that's true or not, I can't tell you. But monitoring up with advanced technology, bridges, where we can find out if there's a minute crack in a structural member that we can fix today for $30,000 instead of waiting 5 years where it costs us $1 million, that sounds smart. And however, there's a silo mentality within transportation departments today where when you discuss how about putting on this kind of technology, they say we have no money in the budget, and that comes from the experts in the field. And we ought to change that mindset. It's the 21st century. Yes.
Tony K. Nash, I represent the state DOTs. I don't see the perverse nature of the provisions in the law. Nash, over years, has publicly testified to change the law to do it out based on asset management. I don't see states gaining it.
Yes.
States spend more money in state money on bridges, plus progress the federal aid program is eligible for bridges. So I don't see that. You see the argument, and clearly I'd like to say it, but asset management is.
Well, the
perverse logic to have it in law that way, but I don't see that perverse. Number one. Number two, I really love your analyses. Number three, you want to focus on design innovations, construction innovations, because MICA right now is focusing on the bridge, but he's focusing on how quickly it was replaced. Lots of innovations right now in accelerated bridge construction. We're going to have on July 4th this summer, you're going to have 14 structures replaced in 12 weekends in Massachusetts. Roll them on and roll them off. 80 bridges in Utah have already been done. That accelerated bridge construction, looking at total cost, user cost, that should be emphasized in your arguments as well. Mm-hmm. Ways to do it. And you're focusing on pressure critical bridges that are structurally deficient. Well, you're already in the structurally deficient area, so you're not gained by expanding the eligibility of the bridge program. You already captured those bridges in the It might be interesting to see where those 8,000 bridges lie percentage-wise across the states. But argumentatively, it's very difficult to confirm that all Congress argument. I'd love to work with you on that.
I think it's going to take us 2 or 3 months not only to get it up, but to check all the facts with the committee. You know, some of those bridges over the last year and a half may have been fixed. Thank you. Let me talk to you about perverse incentives. I'll tell you a perverse incentive. In 2006, a year before the I-35W bridge went down, URS, who was dragged into this report and this case on the tragedy on that bridge, issued a report. And they made 3 recommendations, 2 short-term and 1 long-term, the long-term being change the whole deck. You know, let's get the whole thing out of there and put in a solid bridge deck. But 2 of them were just take the fracture critical members and add redundancy, okay? The Transportation Department voted to put those recommendations off by 13 years, 20-something years, and 47 years, okay? By making that decision to save a couple of million dollars on putting in the supports for the fracture critical members, they were perversely rewarded with $275 million of federal money to build a brand new state-of-the-art bridge, for which they were honored, and which the bridge engineer who was in charge of that bridge before it went down was given a financial bonus an incentive for his good work. That's perverse.
Also shows you don't rate them more on risk factors.
Yes.
Risk, that bridge had impacts on rail, had impacts on market, impacts on trucking. We also supported the brand rallying around risk management more.
I couldn't agree with you more.
That, you know, replacing the structure is another story. I think that was more a political level where they knew you and I, the world, they knew the conditions there, and the governor refused to.
Read the NTSB report. Draw your own conclusions. Draw your own. Peter.
Pete Van Der Zee, the aforementioned. Just following up on Tony's comment, the thing that I don't think anybody's really got their arms around yet is the fact that we've had a visual inspection protocol for 40 years in this country for bridges. FHWA did an interesting study 10 years ago and proved that that process is subjective and highly variable. Their words, not mine.
Yes.
You can find the study online. Now,
I cited it in the book, by the way.
In the book. Now, if you were short money, like I think we're going to be faced with for 20 or 30 years, you don't want to fix bridges that don't need to be fixed, but you want to jump on the ones that really do need to be fixed. And separating one from the other is impossible with visual inspection.
Yes.
It can't be done. However, the technologies that you talk about in the book and that has been discussed today, we're quite capable of that. In fact, our industry is finding out that 30 to 40% of bridges that we evaluate are not deficient. They're better to much better condition than actually is indicated by visual inspection. So the number isn't 70,000, it's probably more like 45,000.
Well,
it becomes more manageable. That's what we need to do. I agree with you on fracture critical, and you know that. But, golly, you know, it's not as bad a problem as we all think it is. It can be done, but you've got to use the technology. You can't rely on Bobby and Joe to look at a bridge and tell you whether it's good or bad. It doesn't work.
And also, the URS consultants had recommended monitoring that bridge before it collapsed. They rejected that. Had the monitoring been in place as the contractor was piling up the construction material on the bridge, something that MnDOT should never have allowed in the first place, while they were piling it up, the blips on the screen would have shown, you know, asymmetric loading, which means something perverse is happening to unbalance the bridge long before they got to the point where the equivalent of a loaded 747 was piled up on that fracture-critical bridge.
Yeah, I'm Jack Kinslinger. I'm with an engineering firm and had been a DOT secretary. And, you know, the DOTs are as concerned about safety as you. They're under tremendous pressure to stretch the money.
That's right.
I mean, there's a reason why a typical major highway in Europe lasts 50 years and in America lasts for 20 years, because they build thick to last long. We build it thin so that we can build more miles for the dollars, because the political pressure is there to deliver more and more. And that happens, and it happens at a time when money is scarce and demand is great. But, you know, the states have moved towards maintenance and repair. In Maryland this year is devoting 3% of its highway budget to new capacity and 97% to maintenance and repair, and most of the other states moved in that direction quite a long time.
Yes, there's more, but what the statistics show, at least through 2009, I'm not going to talk about this year, what the statistics showed, that while that has been happening in terms of the percentages, the impact on those structurally deficient bridges, the impact on these roads that have been damaged, has been marginal. You know, when you go down 30% in the price of your house and somebody says, wow, it was a great year, it went up 5% since that time, after going down 30%, going up 5% is not a great thing. So we have the quantity, the amazing quantity of roads, bridges, built stuff in this country is so incredible that we've got to get this problem with our arms around it now, because the numbers multiply every 5 and 10 years to phenomenal. Just remember, in 2 or 3 years, the ASCE number to fix our infrastructure went from $1.6 trillion to $2.2 trillion. Our last count, that was $600 billion. And it's going to be more the next time around. We have a signal.
Alicia.
Yeah, I found one state that has been very, very out front and has had tremendous results. They should be a model, and I talk about it in the book, the state of Oregon. State of Oregon has used advanced technology widespread throughout and have made major savings in maintenance costs. So there are these models of states where they get it. And they should be prominently displayed. I mean, I can write a book, but we need people to talk about it. You know, I can only do my share, but there are these states who really understand how to allocate sparse dollars and get the biggest bang for the buck. Technology is the best way we can do it. The best way today, after fixing those fractured critical bridges. Go ahead. Last question.
David Burwell, Carnegie Endowment. So I'm a Tea Party member and I'm listening to you, right? And I'm hearing everything about design flaws, bad allocation of money, bad construction practices, design flaws. Pavement deteriorates very quickly. My conclusion is I'm never going to give $1 to this program until they get fixed. And so the question is, how do we, with all these problems, how does anybody develop the argument that this program needs to be refunded? We're stuck in a paradox here where we've got so many problems with the program. Nobody wants to fund it now.
This is a great question because it's timely within the context of the political fracturalization that we're dealing with. I believe that the current system of way we fund transportation and infrastructure is fatally flawed. It allows too much money to go in places where it ultimately ends up not intended. And if we don't identify a way to asset manage, to have a cost-benefit analysis for every project, if we don't create a nationwide database that allows us to say this is the formula for determining the return on investment, then we shouldn't be doing business as before in terms of funding hundreds of billions of dollars. The throwing money at this problem is not the solution. Articulating an understanding of what the problem is and whether or not we're going to get our bang for the buck is what we need to do. And we have smart people in this country. In this room alone, if we got in, we were allowed to recast the transportation system, it wouldn't look like we currently have it now. We understand the problems today. But that's not the political environment we're in. So I can't speak to that. I'm not in the political realm. But I can say what makes sense. And when you study asset management and you say, does it make sense or not? When you study what are we going to get out of this so from a society standpoint, from a return on investment standpoint, and you look at all the criteria, that's what the people who invest in public-private partnerships do. They have the smartest financial advisors. That's why they know what they're doing, and the government doesn't necessarily have the same advantage. We need that sophistication on the side of every government project to determine whether or not we are being smart. If it's just about a politician saying, give me the money and I know who my friends are, that's not smart. And we need to change that once and for all. If it doesn't get changed, business will go on as usual. Bridges will collapse. Gravity wins.
Well, let me respond, because that's not the way it works. I ran two DOTs. We spent an inordinate amount of time prioritizing projects. We had public hearings. We did benefit costs. We did volume capacity. We did roughnecks index. We did all kinds of analyses. We prioritized the projects. The bridges without redundancy went to the top. Most states spend an incredible amount of money getting it right. And other than earmarks, there is very little political influence on how that is done. Because it's all done with public hearings. It's all done transparently.
It may have happened in your state, but in Minnesota, exactly the opposite happened. And that's the record in that state. They had a big banner on their website, on MnDOT. We are a remediation first department. Yet 2/3 of all the money they received over the years leading up to that collapse of that bridge were used on new projects as opposed to remediation. So I wish that were going on. The data just doesn't show in many states that that's what was happening, or we wouldn't be in this fix.
Well, folks, our goal for this was to not just hear from Barry and to hear the presentation, but to have this conversation and this dialogue among the experts in the room. And I think we've hit on a couple of really interesting issues. We wanted to be provocative. We wanted to get the conversation going. I think that from our perspective at Brookings, and Barry, I'm sure other folks in the room share the same frustration that we have these conversations, but it's this action that we're really trying to get to that's eluding us for so long. So we're going to continue to work on this. I know Barry is not just writing the book and then disappearing, so he's going to be doing some more work in this area. I want to thank you all for being here today. I want to thank Barry for his great talk, and we'll keep this going. Thanks very much.
Well, thank you. Thanks for everything. Appreciate it.